South Africa's Abdullah Ibrahim with Little Boy. This is from his Voice of Africa album released in 1988. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and I welcome you back today. We had a pretty interesting day yesterday. And I just, if you have anything that you want to say to finish it up, we were talking about the constant state that we put in as a nation. This is not just Black folks and Latino folks, but we've seen this, but they, although they are the majority in this regard of contentious police killings that not only have a history, but seem to have a methodology. I've been reviewing some of these killings that had been covered in the media for the last about 10, 11 years. Not only are the circumstances strikingly similar in terms of the role of police in these communities and the trauma that they cause when in the course of contact that starts out as being very pro forma. You know, there, I can't tell you how many cases I've reviewed that started out as an on-the-spot detention for like a broken light or some other very minor thing. Then soon enough, it escalates and ends in death. Also very common to many of the cases I've been reading about is the fact that the errant police officer or officers seldom feel the wrath of the law. The law. They seem uniformly to be able to walk away from these crimes. And in some cases, the biggest concession that they will give is what amounts to a payoff. They'll throw some money at the family or relatives of the deceased, and that's the end of that. It has seldom been the case, seldom, that true justice was done in a court of law. And that's why I say practically any major news story has to be assumed as having disproportionate impact and effect on communities of color. Entirely different experience, because the end result is so entirely different, because these police officers' attitudes are shaped by a different set of rules and notions of power and authority that go along with that. It is difficult for people to accept that, but at this point, our purpose is to educate the community, both communities, if you will, but primarily I'm interested in educating that community that historically has absorbed an inordinate amount of pain. We really do, as a defense, we do have to learn defense mechanisms. And I'm not suggesting that these situations occur because people don't know about defense mechanisms. They seem to happen anyway. But we really should sharpen our knowledge, which in turn will sharpen our actions. Some people were shot while running away from an encounter with the police, which in our communities is a natural instinct. I mean, I am not advocating one way or the other about justice. I'm saying that we have to accept, based on statistical analysis and information, we must accept and operate with that knowledge that justice is not evenly applied. So there are certain things you must do, and you must know to do as a defense mechanism. Never mind the fact that it places an inordinate burden. But we also know that life in the United States of America as people of color starts out that way and stays that way as having an inordinate burden. We have to persuade people that we are people. We have to immediately acknowledge that you are yielding your power from the word go. You intend not to cause a problem, even though the officers might be causing a very large problem, breaking the law blatantly. But part of your defense mechanism should be to keep things calm, particularly yourself. It's an inordinate burden. It's unfair and it is wrong. But this is our reality. We cannot expect a system to be fair after all these documentations and ongoing proof that the supposed rights, the constitutional protections that we supposedly all enjoy, it's a figment of somebody's imagination. The problem is the system of government and the individual members of the force who enforce that system. That's why it's called policing. In other communities, in Black and Latino communities, it's called law enforcement. Two entirely different psychological approaches, but with the same lethal consequences or potential consequences. We're at a stage where we have to change tactics, even though we have changed tactics in some cases, but the end result continues to be constant. How could anybody tell me with a straight face, as when we covered the Eric Garner case, the police department maintained and government maintained, the system maintained that Eric Garner caused his own death. And it wasn't all of the police officers who were there who did absolutely nothing to interfere with the administration of what they call justice, and that includes the medical people who were there who did nothing to help, really, until it was clear that he was gone. Eric Garner, as far as the system is concerned, he broke the law. Well, what did he do? He sold cigarettes, unstamped cigarettes. And that was tantamount to a murder. He lost his life, though illegally, the chokehold is supposed to be banned. It should never have existed. But that's how his killer saw him. That even if he were to have died during the administration of justice, that is what it was. He was administering justice, and the whole system backed him up. And then they went the typical route of coming to a settlement, etc., etc. Nobody has yet affixed blame, specifically affixed blame in the sense that if you create a crime, if you do a crime of this magnitude, surely somebody's got to pay. That part didn't apply. So we have to revisit these cases and study them, because they are also meant to be instructions for us about how we navigate to the best of our ability in a hostile environment under racist laws that don't care how it looks in the eyes of justice, but that cares how they come off to the constituencies that matter. They go into full gear to protect the criminal, the killers, and place the blame on the victims. This is a major theme in our communities. So we study these things. We develop alternative ways to navigate our world. We don't need any more instruction. We don't need any more legal cases where they dance with the facts. We don't need any more demonstrations of an unequal system. We should accept that this is the way it goes, because there is evidence to help us come to that realization, and that we are fighting for our lives. Collectively, we are fighting for our lives. This is serious business. The major society can afford to concern itself with what we see as secondary or tertiary things. We are at ground zero, and we shouldn't forget that. So there is a bit of space, and then we go on to our subject for today, our designated subject for today, which was to be held yesterday. So if you have any calls, we certainly can take some quick calls about yesterday's topic at 888-874-4888. John from Englewood, you're with us.
Hello.
Hello.
You're coming through loud and clear. If I had known we were going to be discussing yesterday's topic, I wouldn't have made the call, because I called in reference to what you started to talk about to begin with. So I don't know where I'm at.
Well, join the rest of the universe. We don't know where we are. We're going with the flow. Actually, I did announce yesterday that, I changed my mind yesterday, as it turned out. The topic I talked about yesterday was slated for today.
Uh-huh.
But it just hit me so hard. I felt compelled to say something.
Uh-huh.
But I did say that we will leave some time today to finish off, because as the program ended and we looked, I saw a pretty sizable queue of people who wanted to say something before the program was over.
And generally, what was the topic yesterday?
We talked about this. We talked about the...
Okay, so it's pretty much the same thing.
Yes.
Oh, all right, so I'm not at a loss. You used the word tactic. Our only tactic is to be totally submissive or fight. You know, that's our only choice. We only have that. And when I say fight, I'm not talking about arguing, because they only understand one thing, and that is force. That's the only thing they understand. They used to call it the police department. Now it's the police force, you know. Everything is force. You move as fast as you can or jump as high as you can the second I give you an order in a free country. I've been in situations where we were protesting and the police officer was on the street threatening me that you don't come in the street, I'm going to arrest you if you step into the street. Meanwhile, the crowd is pushing me into the street, you know what I mean, as though I had a choice in the matter. I've been driven off the sidewalk by mounted policemen. We're running out of alternatives here. You know, this fellow that was killed in his car, even though he announced that he had a weapon, he had a pistol, he had a permit to have that pistol, and when then he was told to get his license and registration, when he went for his wallet, the cop killed him right in front of his fiance and his child. I mean, there was the woman that got pulled over, a black woman who got pulled over. She was on her way to a job interview. She was all excited about it. She was going to be moving as a result of it. She came out of a driveway and failed to signal. The cop pulled her over. He threatened her. She was indignant. I don't blame her for being indignant as far as when you're encountering police, but you have to be prepared for the consequences. And she ended up, quote unquote, hanging herself in jail. I remember her saying, I can't, this was a learned person, she knew. She said, I can't wait to get you in front of a judge. Referring to the policeman. I can't wait to get you in front of a judge. Little did she know that she would never see a judge. And that's what happened. And to say that they pulled out the number one getaway card, committed suicide, the number one way of getting away with murder. That's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a bunch of hired guns.
We have to be careful too.
I know being careful.
We can't make blanket statements in that sense. We certainly know that in these specific cases, including the Sandra Bland case that you just referred to, we know what happened and what causes us to be completely skeptical about how justice, quote unquote, happened in these cases. But I go back to your statement about tactics. The idea is for those of us concerned about these kinds of cases, you just talked about Sandra Bland's case. What is the tactic? What is it that we need to know? Is it something that we really don't know what to do? The case of Castile, he did say to the police officer, in the presence of the other police officer on the other side of the car, and in the presence of his fiancée, he did announce that he had a weapon, a concealed weapon, but legally he was carrying a weapon. He even said where it was. But still he ended up dead. So what accounts for that anomaly where a person abides by the law, tells the officer, first of all, I mean, was it such a major offense that it required being stopped by two armed police officers? A broken taillight can result in you being killed? I mean, is that what we should be forced to accept? No. But that's what happened to him, and it wasn't the first such case. We have many cases like that. The man obeyed the law, went beyond that to advise that he was carrying a weapon. He told them what it was. a handgun. He told them where he had it, in his pocket. And he told them, okay, officer, I think you ought to know. I'm telling you, or advising you, something to this effect, he said, that I am carrying a weapon. He learned that from wherever he went to receive training, because he was now a gun owner. He went through the required training, and this was one of the things he was trained to do, to advise the police that he had a weapon. He did exactly what he was told to do. So I'm saying we have to develop some means by which people become fully aware, not paranoid or anything like this, because that's, you know, people don't understand that for many Americans, life is a daily exercise in controlling paranoia. They didn't start it. It's inflicted on them. You're going down the street, you with your fiance, you're doing some shopping. Next thing you know, you're dead. And she is there trying to figure out, well, what can I do in this situation to document this awful thing? She had a phone with a camera on it. And that's what she did. Now, to people, that it sounds kind of crazy. And perhaps even to her, this was who was ever placed in a position like this where you have to think? I'm trying to illustrate here that it is not said, but it is nonetheless experienced directly by millions of African Americans, that this is the life they live, not because they choose to live this way, or they want to live this way, or they think this is the most ideal way to live, but conditions imposed upon them basically force them to live this way and to regard it as normal. You make a great point, and that is that we are being pushed into a situation where we cause our own death. The plan clearly is to do just that, to achieve annihilation, to achieve a genocidal plan by pushing people and pushing their buttons so they clear themselves out of the way. Thanks for your call. David, we'll take your call and perhaps two more, and we move on with the topic for today.
Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Yes, okay. As we discuss this particular topic, what comes into my mind is this is business as usual. The only difference is the modern technology with the videos, photographs, and so forth that comes into play. In order to survive, I can think of my own life. If I wasn't skillful enough, I'd be in prison or something would have happened to me. But I was fortunate enough to have the skills to avoid the police doing me in, like when I was told by the sheriff that I was a black man, I'm supposed to say yes, sir, to every white man. That's the sheriff told me that. And anything could have happened to me. Now, what I'm trying to get across is that this is the nature, here we get the system analysis again, of the system that we live here in this country, in particular in the United States. And that was codified during the 17th century after the Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia. And the main thing that I think people ought to get into their heads is the only way you can run a system like this where you have committed ethnic cleansing and genocide with the indigenous people and slavery for the recent arrivals from Africa during that time and forward is to divide and conquer. So we have to get it through our heads. The only way that they can maintain the exploitation of all the working class people, as those who have read Theodore Allen's book or Jeff Turry's work, you have to divide and conquer people and the working class. To exploit them, you must do certain things, and including for those people in that invented category called white, to have more privilege than the one in the category called black and so forth. So part of that is that white policemen certainly can do extrajudicial executions that they want, and nothing's going to happen to them. I remember living in the South where quite often black people were killed by the police and there was no big thing about it. So we have to understand that the system we live in depends on divide and conquer. I think everybody, if they get that in their head, and there's nothing special whatsoever about abuse of the dominated people. And in this case, it's the African-Americans mostly and the Latinos and indigenous people. So, you know, if people would get that through their head and not be surprised when the police do these types of things. And I'm very fortunate because I can remember as a child that I was always accused of some crime when I was in a group of European people. And if someone stole something and I was the only black person there, the first thing they would do is come to me and say, "Can we search you?" You see? So, and I went through that in the primary level, the secondary level, and the tertiary level in college, where I was accused of someone saw me walking along with some equipment that belonged to the college, and they naturally thought I was stealing equipment, you see. So the point is you have to have the skills to know how to deal with these authorities and the police, or you're going to wind up dead, and that could have happened to me.
It is a very scary thing, and we have to talk about it. And we have to talk about it because it is, in fact, the silent killer. And I talked at length about the methods outside of the specific incident that are used to, you know, wipe it over, just wipe it clean. No evidence of intent by police to harm anybody. But there are plausible explanations, and that is what the people get. We also have the, I've also talked about the different roles that even people from our own community, the so-called leaders who play these roles, the push by lawyers to settle quickly for a pittance of money because, hey, well, it's something.
Silver rights, silver rights.
Silver
rights. Yeah. I'd like to add, I was talking to a person who was a policeman, African-American policeman, and he was telling me that among his colleagues, so-called European colleagues, he has met those who were looking forward to the first person they could shoot. You know, you have certain people that go for certain types of jobs that have, you know, psychological problems.
Sure.
Problems like that, who want to get into a position where they can kill somebody. Just like with soldiers quite often, they want to take trophies. And, you know, so you do have people in authority like law enforcement quite often who are looking forward to doing that kind of thing. So that's not surprising at all. And the other part of this, I might say, when we're talking about killing is, and the system of white supremacy racism that was put into effect, codified in the 17th century, is that the victims of this type of treatment, in particular African-Americans, have been programmed to have such a self-hatred of each other. So that is why you have a large number of black people killing each other. If you don't think you're worth anything, what are you going to think about someone else that looks like you? And that happens quite often. And, you know, that doesn't justify what the police do, but we have to understand how the system is designed to destroy its victims to make profit for itself in the system, especially the one we have here in the United States of America.
Well, thank you so much. We'll move on now and start our discussion on the other issue, and maybe some of you who are still online would participate in that discussion instead. But, you know, come Friday, we have time with each other on Free Your Mind Friday. And as warrants, as we go, we will just get to the subject. So don't worry if you're not yet in queue for commentary on that. We'll find a way to accommodate your thoughts. Well, this part of the program asks what I consider to be an inevitable question, and that is it time to end the two-party system? If the 2016 presidential election proved nothing else, it surely proved how tenaciously we hang on to the notion that two is quite enough. Thank you. That's what the system is saying. Two is quite enough. Two political parties, that's quite enough. And there's no need to change it. So today we'll tackle this other part of the discussion of why is two and only two enough? What is the fear here of expanding political choice? What is holding up what is so clearly evident, and that is you give people as many choices as possible to fully express their political intentions and their political will. So we're asking the question, is it time to end the two-party system? Because to my mind, based on what we discuss on the program so often, it's the uniparty, the bird with two of the same wings, it's not enough. There is no room there to truly express the will of the people. But there is certainly a great effort to stop that from happening. Your thoughts at 888-874-4888. I'll move down the line with Khalil from North Carolina. Are you there, Khalil?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, great. Okay. You know, that I love your question, and I would like to chime in on the previous topic on Friday, but what you're talking about now, this is the time in terms of this two-party system. It obviously, when you look at it from an analytical point of view, we're dealing with two private clubs, okay? Almost as if you're going to the country club and you don't have a membership. And most of us do not have a membership to either club. Our interests and our needs are not being met. And I think maybe that's what you often intimate and outright say many days. And I think you're correct. So that being said, I'm sorry?
No, I was just going to ask you to elaborate on your answer.
Okay. Well, obviously our needs are not being met because of lobbyists and big money. Now, of course, we do have a bicameral system starting at the state level and moving into the federal level, which makes this difficult. However, with this recent Supreme Court decision with the dark money of Citizens United, we can use that against the system. Because since they want to get money from anywhere untracked, untraced, which has led to this mess that we're in now, that's what we need to do. Because we're not the only people talking about this. And the reason it's we're at a critical moment right now, it's something a lot of people maybe are not thinking about. And that is the fact that if you look at all the state houses, all the state legislatures, and the way Congress and the House of Representatives is set up, these folks are out. Oh, if you listen closely, if you watch C-SPAN, these people, Republicans, they want to evoke a constitutional convention. And what that means is the Constitution will be rewritten. Everything's on the table at that point. And they are very close to having all the votes to do it. And because they know parliamentary procedures, they will be able to do this. So we may have only maybe two and a half years to get this done or to do something if people don't wake up. And this is very serious business.
It is very serious. And we'll continue talking about it because it sometimes in the midst of adversity, you have great opportunity. The question is, do we recognize it as such? And if we do recognize it as such, coming back to your point, it's time we get started. Thanks so much for your call. Patricia, you're on the air. Patricia?
Hi, good afternoon. How are you? I hope all is well, and good afternoon to the PRN family.
Thank you, and thank you.
You know, Eutrice, it is very disturbing when I hear everyone talking about the 2018 midterm elections and how important it is for black folks to vote for the Democratic Party because, you know, in 2016, we were not even on the agenda. You had all of these killings of African-American men, women, and children. You had the water crisis in Flint. You have the fact that we have no jobs in the critical age between 21 and 45 when we're forming families. You have 50% of African-American men with no jobs. We can't get health care. We can't get housing. And yet still, the Democratic Party got over 90% of African-American women and men vote. With all of this on the table, we were not even in the discussion. And so you have to ask yourself, what is the problem? And so you look at somebody like Cory Booker, who has taken, you know, over $20,000 from Jared Kushner. And, you know, recently they were talking about, there was a discussion about revoking Jared Kushner's security clearance. And Cory said, well, you know, it was too soon to have that discussion. And you have people like Chuck Schumer, and these are Democrats. You have people like Chuck Schumer, who are accepting money from Trump and all the Ivanka kids and Jared Kushner. So what, you know, so I say to people, what are you voting for? You're voting to continue to kill your family? You're voting to continue not having health care? You're voting to continue not being able to drink clean water and then have to pay the taxes for the water that you can't even drink? So the whole question of two parties, to me, is an absolutely ridiculous discussion. Because if you're supposed to be voting for people who are going to promote and take care of your interests and you're not in the discussion, then what are you voting for? So the whole, so for me, we need to expand and we need a party that's going to talk to black folks, that's going to talk to black and brown people, that is going to equalize and at least give us an opportunity to be participants in the discussion.
In that scenario, where would you place parties that already exist? And say, well, you know, like the Socialist Party, the Green Party.
Well, we weren't on their agenda either. We weren't on their agenda either. So clearly, we're not on anybody's agenda. So we need to create a party where we're at the center of the agenda. We're not on anybody's radar. We're not on anybody's agenda.
I agree. Well, you know my views. I've said it often enough. Maybe this is a perfect time to give them a second chance, or a third or a fourth or a fifth. Listen, it hasn't gone well for you between the party and our community. Here's your chance to get it together and see if enough people find reason to support you. So we have a double agenda here. The first part of the agenda is to voice or confirm our discontent. We do not have, you're absolutely right. We are not at the center of any party with respect to an agenda. We're not at the center of that. Maybe this would spark those parties that are at least nominally equipped to build on presence, however rare it is in our community, to rethink their options. But we have to think about this very seriously. As I told you, I pulled out of party politics more than 20 years ago. There was no point to it, except that I show up like an automaton and pull a lever and then go home, having fulfilled my so-called civic duty. Nobody cares about my civic duty. They just care that I registered during the course of the day as one of the people supporting their party. But I stopped that. I found it to be abusive, and I stopped it. And I'm intending also to encourage the discussion. Did I really need the party? I mean, in those 20 years, did I assist the Democratic Party in standing up for issues that represented the concerns of the community as a whole? The answer is no.
No. You're in the same place that you would have. You've ended up in the same place that you would have had you pulled the lever. It made absolutely no difference. And, you know, I think back to Martin Luther King, his Stride for Freedom speech, where he talks about oppressed people, they deal with their oppression in three ways. And one is just to give up and resign themselves to their fate. And I think that's pretty much where we are. The other two are violence, and then the other one is nonviolent resistance. But I think black people have just given up. I don't think they feel that they have any power in their hands to do anything but just continue to go to the polls and do what you describe as their civic duty without ask. You, even now, when you listen to the Democrats, not only are we not even on the table, see, now they're talking about middle America. They got to get those white middle Americans who voted for Trump. That's their focus now. Because we all went to the polls, we asked for nothing, we got nothing, and they got our vote.
Now tell me, where is common sense in all of that? That's the discussion we ought to be having. Where to go? Who looks logical? And start talking to people who are on that line of thinking. We should hear from all these different parties now what ideas they have, having seen the result, having experienced this presidential election. Now is a time to begin rigorous dialogue and to look for evidence that people are really seriously interested in meaningful contact and moving ahead, but moving ahead differently and sensibly. Thank you so much, Patricia, for your call today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have Maat. You're on the air.
I'm coming. Yes, Hotep, beloved family.
You have to. You sound like you were like Usain Bolt's sister. How fast you got to the phone there?
What's that?
I said when you said, "I'm coming in no time flat." You were there, so I thought maybe you're taking lessons from Usain Bolt.
That's because I'm a night owl, and I'm getting ready to in a little while to go out of here, so I'm trying to sneak some shut-eye as I'm waiting for you to go to the calls. But, okay, let me try to pivot because I had originally called, and I guess I'll have to try to be up and awake some Friday because I definitely have some thoughts on the first part of discussion and an important point of clarification regarding Eric Garner, because he actually wasn't selling cigarettes. That wasn't his spot. But I'll explain that at another time.
No, that's first. I refer because that was the explanation given. See, they give explanations as to why they had to do what they had to do.
Yeah. He had a certain spot by the ferry. And one of the reasons why that the family didn't get the property, because and it became out initially, he didn't even have any cigarettes on him. And the store owner also. But what he did happen, and a sister called in to a popular sister radio station, and she had spoken to his father. He did go in and tried to make a complaint in one of the precincts because they were shaking him down from his money he had. So, that, you know, that's a whole nother thing, but it just goes on and on. But getting to this idea, and I want to say something that I agree with a lot of Patricia said, except that I think that we just can't dismiss the Green Party in total because they did have the vision. Ajamo Baraka, he knows what's going on. I hear him as a fairly regular on the Black Agenda Report with Glenn and Nelly. But the problem is we have a neo-fascist system. That's what it is when people don't even understand the definition of fascism. When the corporations merge with the political system, which has been going on for a long time, that's what fascism is. And in terms of this situation with Donald Trump, we shouldn't even be surprised because in certain respects, it was always headed this way. So what I can say about this is, first of all, we need to get some more political education, understand how this whole system is ruled. And I think Utrice and family, I think David Icke makes a good point because he explains it as a pyramid. And we don't really realize the power that we have of the mass of the pyramid. And he illustrates knowing some performer who was sick one day, and you know how the acrobats build up the pyramid, and the person on the lower level was faltering, and the whole thing tumbled down. And so that's kind of the situation we're in. We're dealing with an ignorant mass of people who are essentially suicide bombers in their own right, just ramping up the neo-fascist agenda, and we have to come with a blueprint of self-determination solutions because this system is not about to break out of the two-party entrenched fascist, neo-fascist system.
But we have been saying here on this program for quite some time, the people who want to lead or the people who think they are best equipped to lead are not showing that. You have to have a leader when all is said and done. A people, you know, just as a people, loosely affiliated with each other, loosely affiliated with the concept of the political ideology that they're following. You need people to bring them together under a shared roof. We're not seeing, and you couldn't ask for a better time. In a situation like this, where there's mass confusion and anxiety and people having fears about their capacity to cope with what's coming, let alone what's already here. This is a time that you pull out all of your tricks. This is a time when all gaskets are supposed to be firing, and you get dug in. You get into communities if you weren't there before. You have an opportunity to match your deficiencies from the last election with a new approach that may very well take hold. But it is what month is this now? This is the sixth month, practically. And we're hearing nothing but, you know, whistling crickets.
Chaos presidency.
We can't have this and have success at organizing. Anybody in a leadership capacity knows this is precisely the time you get out into the communities, that you hustle, that you make yourself known and visible. But we're not seeing that either. So indirectly, I'm saying to those people and the parties that are represented or were represented, review your plan, but become, you know, actionable. That people see you. You're not without access to the media. You're not without the ability to attend community forums. I mean, you had in Flint practically the entire city sickened by a system, in some cases permanently. And except for the fact that we had people in the community coming out and raising all kinds of hell about it, as they should, where were the members of Congress? Where were the state leaders? It's unbelievable to me that such a tragedy, such a scope could be occurring right under their eyes, and this does not constitute a crisis important enough for them to, you know, visibly show that they are doing something to figure out what the next step is. So in the aftermath of the 2016 election, we have any number of visible failures that would work to the advantage of a great many insurgents. They provided ammunition for people who didn't do well numerically, but have a good heart, have a good spirit, and can work right now to build a political base if they don't have one already, but to begin to build. That's what I'm saying.
I agree, Utis, and I'd like to hear some of your concerns and commentary on the piece on the front page, June 22nd, June 28th, Amsterdam News. Man's head left on Miami, Mississippi stoop in Jackson, Mississippi, where they have a new black mayor-elect, in fact, the son of Chakwe Lumumba, and it was two men. I don't know if you're familiar with the case, but we'd like your thoughts. Two men seem to have been lynched, and the police aren't even looking at white supremacists. They're talking about MS-13. Doesn't look like MS-13, but I look forward to your comments when you see the article.
Well, I'll give it to you right now. Until the African-American community demonstrates that it can handle its own business, they shouldn't expect anything from this system. They didn't get it when you had an African-American U.S. Attorney General. They didn't get it when you had an African-American president. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting it now with an African-American U.S. attorney again. So when they say these things, it's the party politics. The Democratic Party, that traditionally was its base. Actually, as I mentioned before, it was the blacks who created the Republican Party. The Democratic Party was late to the game. It originated with African Americans, who went on, by the way, to found the to be the first blacks elected to Congress, elected to the House of Representatives. African Americans did that. They were so successful, and there were only what, five of them?
You're talking about doing so-called Reconstruction?
Reconstruction, yes. And they changed the face of politics in America. But they formed the Republican Democratic Party, or the Democratic Republican Party was what it was called. They were so successful. And every one of them was a son of a slave.
Hmm.
So when people start talking about, well, you know, this happened, it was a period and you couldn't ask for a more hostile environment. But they persevered. They went all over the place and preached a message. And people saw it. That was what scared white America. So we have to be accountable to ourselves, because we absented ourselves from responsibility for ourselves. And we got to get back to that. Thanks a lot. Brings us to the end of our program today. I thank you all for calling in and contributing. Of course, we can get to these subjects as we go. The idea is that we want to wake people up. We want to give them information to form a resolute political identity as we move on, as a collective, to change this horrible society. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always and a great privilege. I'm so honored about that, to be in your company. See you tomorrow. A great program to come up tomorrow coming your way. Bye-bye.